Kennan.
Hi, Kerry. Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm Kerry Howley, a contributing editor at Reason Magazine.
I'm Kennan Malik. I'm a writer, broadcaster, lecturer. I'm a senior visiting fellow at University of Surrey. I've just got a book out on race called Strange Fruit, Why Both Sides Are Wrong. And actually, I thought I might show you this, which is the cover of my new book.
I was hoping you'd show us, because I only have it in PDF form, which is a lot less photogenic.
Right, okay. Well, if you can see this, I'm not sure you can see this on the camera, but if you can, it's called From Fatwa to Jihad, and it's about the Rushdie Affair and its legacy. It's out in the spring.
Okay. Well, I was hoping we could talk about Strange Fruit and
sure.
Why both sides in the race debate are wrong, so you can just sort of tell everyone who's watching exactly what they've got wrong, and that's the best kind of dialogue, I think. So you have some very nuanced, interesting views about the biological reality of race. I think that the typical educated American stance would be that we have these social categories, race, that are important for various reasons, but they don't map on to any actual scientific reality. Why is that wrong?
Well, there are clearly real genetic differences between human populations, and the scientific study of these differences are very important in helping us to unravel the roots of disease, to develop new medicines mm-hmm. and clinical techniques, to unpick details of human history and migrations. But such genetic differences are not the same as racial differences, because race describes a way not just of categorising human beings, but of selecting certain categories based usually on skin colour or appearance or descent as being of particular importance. And racial thinking divides human beings into a small set of discrete groups, each of which possesses, you know, a fixed set of traits and abilities, and it regards the differences between these groups as the defining feature of humanity. And all these beliefs, I think, run counter to scientific views of population differences.
Okay.
Let's give you a good example. Now, different populations, if you take medicine, different populations clearly show different patterns of disease and disorders. North Europeans, for instance, are more likely to suffer from cystic fibrosis than other groups. Tay-Sachs particularly affects Ashkenazi Jews. Beta blockers appear to be less effective on African-Americans than those of European descent. And yet race is not a particularly good guide to disease, or in fact to any other kind of human diversity. We know, for instance, that sickle cell anemia is a black disease, except that it isn't. Sickle cell is a disease of populations originating in areas with high incidence of malaria. Some of these populations are black and some are not. You can find the sickle cell gene in Equatorial Africa, parts of southern Europe and southern Turkey, parts of the Middle East, and in large swathes of central India. Most people, however, know about sickle cell because they know that African Americans suffer disproportionately from the trait. And given popular ideas about race, people automatically assume that what applies to black Americans applies to all blacks and only to blacks. So it's a social imagination, not the biological reality of race, that turns sickle cell into a black disease.
I see. But is there not some role for race as a rough proxy? If a certain race walks into my office as a doctor, is it not helpful for me to even consider there is some connection between people who present with dark skin and sickle cell anemia. Should I just completely ignore that?
Oh, not at all. But the thing to remember is that that there are genetic differences between populations. Though the way we socially divide up populations is not always the best way to define the populations that are important for particular questions. Another way of putting it is that the character of race in scientific research is ambiguous, because race is in effect a social category but with biological consequences. See, geneticists can distinguish between all sorts of populations. Some of these distinctions are useful scientifically, some are not. Whether or not they're useful depends on the questions we want to ask and the context in which we ask it. But the populations that geneticists distinguish are largely socially defined one. And that's because there's no such thing as a natural human population. things like migration, intermarriage, war and conquest, forced assimilation, voluntary embrace of new or of multiple identities, religious or cultural or national or ethnic or racial, any number of social and economic and other barriers to interactions and hence to reproduction. Social rules for defining populations, such as the one drop rule in America, which which suggests that Barack Obama is black, which is why we regard him as a black man. All these and many other social factors impact upon the character of a group and transform its genetic profile. And that's why racial categories are actually very, very difficult to define scientifically. If you read a scientific paper which uses racial categories, there's a big distinction between the tightness of the way that such a paper would define physiological processes or genes, or specific genes, and the looseness of the language when it uses when it comes to racial differences. In fact, what scientists do is import popular notions of race into scientific discussions. But the point is that many of the ways in which we customarily group people socially, you know, by race, by ethnicity, by nationality, by religious affiliations, by geographical locality, and so on, are not arbitrary from a biological point of view. Members of such groups often show greater biological relatedness than to randomly chosen individuals, because such groups have often been ghettoised by a coercive external authority, as in South Africa, for instance, during the apartheid era, or have chosen to self-segregate from other groups. And hence they're inbred to a certain degree and act as in a way that you suggested, as surrogates, however imperfectly, for biological relatedness. So categories such as, African-American or people of Asian descent or Ashkenazi Jew can be important in medical research, not because they're natural races, but because they are, if you like, social representations of certain aspects of genetic variation, and therefore they become useful in addressing questions about human genetic differences and genetic commonalities. And the irony in all this is that In order to study genetic differences between populations, what scientists actually use are social categories, not natural ones. But that's what you need in order to study genetic variation. And so there's a kind of ambiguity in the way we understand race. Categories are social, but there are biological distinctions between them.
The origin of the social division of races can seem so shockingly arbitrary. I mean, Richard Rodriguez talks about the way, Nixon invented Hispanics in 1972. This entire social category by which, you know, people define themselves and we define others was just kind of pulled out of thin air in a way by American immigration law and the census.
Well, that's right. If you look at census categories over the past century, vary quite widely, and you kind of carve out new categories as the political social need arises. So yes, the social categories are very, very different. You take the Asians in America. Asians means some scientists would call East Asians. In other words, largely Japanese, Koreans, Chinese, and so on. In Britain, Asians means South Asians, Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, and so on. But in a kind of classical scientific racial categorizing, South Asians are Caucasians, in other words, the same race as Europeans. But of course, popularly, they're seen as different races.
Right.
So all these distinctions and the way we categorize people socially creates all sorts of confusions. Nevertheless, it is also precisely because there are biological consequences of social categorization, there can be, in certain circumstances, if used carefully, important in medical and scientific research.
Interesting. In your book, you talk about this sense that I think a lot of people have that racism is a human inevitability, that we're just wired that way. But that doesn't seem, given the history you give, to be... there was a sense of universalism, for instance, in the Enlightenment that we seem to have lost today. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, I think the point is that if you look historically at the idea of race, it changes very much over time. the Greek notion of human differences is very different from the medieval notion of human differences, which is very different from the Enlightenment and the contemporary notion of human differences. So the way we understand human differences has varied over history. And the idea that human differences are set in our biology is actually a very, very new notion. It's certainly the case that Greeks saw differences between human populations. But the key difference for them was not biological, but civilizational, in a sense, the distinction between the civilized and the barbarians.
So where you ranked was kind of an accident of birth?
That's right. I mean, if you go to the Middle Ages, if you go to Europe in, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th century, there's a tendency to view differences in terms not of biology or of inheritance, but of in terms of faith and law. People were one people according to their relationship to their faith and to the law. And it's only much more recently the question of biological differences becomes so important, and it does so through the 18th and 19th centuries. And it does so, I think, in a way differently from where the way in which most people understand it. I think the key question is that what develops in the 18th and 19th century is a seeming contradiction between an abstract notion, abstract belief in equality, which arises out of the Enlightenment, and the reality of a world which seems increasingly unequal. And race becomes a way of understanding that contradiction, because people come to see, come to explain that difference between an abstract belief in equality and the reality of an unequal world by saying that certain people are by nature incapable of progress, incapable of being equal. And so you can see that idea developing through the 18th and 19th centuries. It's also interesting, and if you look at the 19th century idea of race, it's very different from the 20th century notion of race. Now, we think about race largely in terms of skin colour. We talk about blacks and whites, and we define people, different races, largely in terms of skin colour. Well, in the 19th century, particularly in Europe, the distinction was less about skin colour than it was about social status and class. So the people, the poor of Bethnal Green, there are great articles in newspapers from the mid-19th century in Britain about the poor of Bethnal Green, which is a poor area of East London, and how they were the relationship between them and the rich is a bit like the relationship between Negroes and whites in America. And they talk about them as a distinct different race. So the whole notion of race has changed considerably over the past 200 years. I mean, it's a very new phenomenon and very new idea, but even over the past 200-300 years, the idea of race has changed quite considerably.
But in the present, you're quite critical of what you see as a sort of emergent race realism on the left. Is that right? Mm. I mean, this idea that your identity is completely wrapped up in your biological descent seems to be quite constraining.
Yeah, I think we've become obsessed by the question of identity, and culture has come to bear the burden of race, if you like. There's a tendency, growing tendency, to view culture and cultural identity as fixed, and to view groups as homogenous wholes. I think multicultural policy is based on such an idea. And an identity, in a sense, I put it like this, an identity has become a bit like a private club, and once you join up, you have to abide by the rules. But unlike, say, the Groucho or the Garrick or whatever the equivalent is in America, it's a private club you must join. So if you're black or if you're Muslim or if you're Native American, there are certain authentic ways of behaving as such. Otherwise, you're not authentically black or Muslim or Native American. I mean, it comes very clearly in relation to the debate about Islam, that only certain kinds of Muslims are authentically Muslims. In fact, the Muslim community, there's no such thing as the Muslim community. There are many Muslim communities. There are many strands within the Muslim community. But secular Muslims, for instance, aren't seen as real Muslims. only fundamentally religious Muslims are seen as real, authentic Muslims. Now, when I grew up in the 80s in Britain, there was a very strong secular tradition within Muslim communities. See, these days, when we talk about radical in the Muslim context, we mean someone who's religiously fundamentalist. Well, 25 years ago, it meant the very opposite. Radical in the Muslim context meant someone who was militantly secular, someone like me. And that shift has changed because only certain types of Muslims are seen as authentically so. Others are, they're not Muslim. And therefore, this notion of authenticity constrains the way people should or have to behave, because they have a certain identity, certain ways of behaving, certain scripts, life scripts they have to follow.
Doesn't it play out in certain interesting ways across the culture? I mean, the obsession with genealogy, this idea that I need to find a story about myself to give myself an authentic identity. I need to find through my ancestors who I really am, and various cultural products. I mean, this cultural script of I'm an American immigrant, but I don't feel real somehow until I've gone back to my homeland, even if I've never been there and have no actual connection or social network there.
Well, that's right. It's interesting how identity is becoming much more tied up with genetics.
Mm-hmm.
You can get these DNA testing kits now where you test your DNA, find out where you come from, and it's as if that tells you who you really are.
Right.
It was a program, a documentary on the BBC a few years ago called Motherland, where they took three Black Britons, tested their DNA, and traced them back to their ancestry. Now, there are major problems with the science of that, largely because you have lots of ancestors, and what they were tracing was just one set of ancestors. But nevertheless, accepting that, what happened was that there was one woman, for instance, who found her ancestors came from a small island off the coast of West Africa. And the next thing you found out, she'd flown off out there. She was there. The camera's following her. She's saying, I found who I am. I know where I am. This is home for me. She's never been there in her life.
Yeah.
And yet it's home. And the whole notion of Black identity in that sense, or identity in general, but in this case, Black identity, which 20 years ago would have been political or cultural, has now become increasingly biological or genetic. You want to find your tribe, and that tribe is somehow in your genes.
Yeah, I think that this emerges especially in adoption law or adoption norms, in which I adopt a Chinese child and I'm perceived as taking something from her if she
that's
isn't
right.
given Mandarin lessons or something like that.
This is her
cultural heritage, and even though she may never see this place past the age of 5 days, somehow, that's perceived as a crime against the child.
Well, that's right. There was somebody I know who had adopted a child who was born in India, and he asked me in all earnestness because she'd been brought. He's a Catholic, and she'd been brought up as a Catholic. And he asked me in all earnestness, did I do wrong, and should I have brought her up as a Hindu? And it's just bizarre. It really is bizarre. I mean, why the fact that she was born in India? Why should that dictate what faith, or if any, she should be brought up in?
Right. Now, how this connects to this idea of cultural inertia, I guess, the idea that we are born with a culture and we must remain in that culture because it is who we are, and any lessening of that particular thick culture makes me less of who I am. It relates to cultural preservation, and this is another thing that you're quite critical of in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, just as you said, that there's the idea that there's a problem if cultures get lost, and we need to preserve cultures. Mm-hmm. You can see that in Canada, for instance, in relation to the preservation of French culture in Canada, or the preservation of Native American culture in the US. And this whole notion of cultural loss, cultural preservation, cultural decay It's very, very reactionary. Because in one sense, you can never lose your culture. French culture is what French people do. Native American culture is what Native Americans do. Culture is embodied in the behaviour, the rules, the institutions, the activities of real living people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only lose one's culture. It only makes sense if culture is defined not by what people are doing in the here and now, but what they should be doing. And what should they be doing? Well, they should be doing what their ancestors were doing.
Right.
And so
right.
Culture gets defined by biological descent. And biological descent is a polite way of talking about race. So we come kind of full circle. Cultural authenticity, cultural preservation is just another way of talking about race without the opprobrium of racial talk, if you like.
I guess from my perspective, the reason why this I see this trend as threatening is that I cover immigration at Reason, and it worries me this idea that the left could be defending a sort of cultural purity as a justification for closed borders.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. I think there's an interesting slippage that's taken place in this debate about multiculturalism, because there are multiculturalism has come to mean two different things. One is the lived experience of diversity. The other is a set of political policies to manage that diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, that set of political policies to manage diversity is rooted in the idea that if you belong to a culture, you have to stay in that culture. That there are certain ways of behaving as part of that culture, and we should respect, institutionalise those aspects of cultures and the differences between cultures. In fact, multiculturalism as a set of political polities undermines, it seems to me, much of what is good about diversity as lived experience. What's good about diversity as lived experience is that it allows you to broaden your horizons, to think about beyond your own narrow identity, to mm-hmm. think about other values, other lifestyles, other ways of living, asking, is this better or is it worse? Would those values be better than mine? Are my values better than theirs? And therefore, it becomes a means of creating a more universal language of citizenship, if you like. Whereas multiculturalism as a political process denies that by undermining the capacity for such dialogue and debate and to make such judgments, because it says people belong to, it puts people in certain ethnic cultural boxes and ensures that they stay there. So yes, there's been a confusion of immigration and multiculturalism, so that people who are pro-immigration tend to be pro-multiculturalism, and people who are anti-immigration tend to be anti-multiculturalism. Someone like me, who's pro-immigration, anti-multiculturalism, for many people, it doesn't make sense to look at the world in that fashion. I think that's an absurd way of thinking about it. I think being pro-immigration, anti-multiculturalism seems to me a perfectly valid way and the only way really to look at the world.
Right. I mean, I think that the only way to respect individuals is to see culture as essentially fluid, because what starts happening once you say, this is what the culture is, we need to preserve it right now, is that you inevitably start constraining individual rights. And that burden actually has to fall on women at some level, because it's going to be their job to reproduce the culture. They're going to be the boundary markers. And inevitably, questions about the decay of the culture and end up to be questions about the birth rate. This is the hysteria Singapore.
It's always the most vulnerable groups, vulnerable sections of those communities that are worst hit by these kinds of policies. I think part of the problem is that there's a kind of constant slippage between the idea of humans as culture-bearing creatures and the idea that humans have to bear a particular culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no human can live outside of culture, but then no human does. But to say that no human can live out of culture outside of a culture is not to say that they have to live inside a particular one, or to say, as you say, that particular cultures must be fixed or eternal. I mean, to view humans as culture-bearing is to see them as social beings and as transformative beings. It suggests that humans have the capacity for change, for progress, for the creation of universal moral political forms through reason, through dialogue and so on. But to view humans as having to bear specific cultures is to deny such a capacity for transformation and suggest that every human being is so shaped by a particular culture that to change or undermine that culture would be to undermine the very dignity of that individual. You know, that the biological fact of being Jewish or Bangladeshi somehow makes a human being incapable of living well, except as a participant of Jewish or Bangladeshi culture, as it is in a particular definition of Jewish or Bangladeshi culture.
Yeah, it argues against the very possibility of mobility.
That's absolutely a change of social progress, yeah. I mean, you know, all change requires cultural change. Social change requires cultural change. Without cultural change, you cannot have social change. You cannot have social progress.
But, I mean, surely there is a loss associated with a language dying out.
Well, yes and no. I mean,
there's also a cost to maintaining a language. There's a cost to, you know, training some tribal people in Upper Burma their tribal language, which might not be particularly useful. And I'm not sure I would want to impose that cost on, you know, a classroom full of children. But I can also acknowledge that there's a loss involved with just letting it die out. And these need
I don't see why, because language is about communication. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people use the language they need to communicate. Languages have always died out. You know, the English we speak now is very different from the English spoken 500 years ago. It's no loss. It's no loss that we don't speak the kinds of language that existed in Europe 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. There is a tendency to see the kind of romantic view of language embodying a certain view of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you lose a language, you lose a certain way of looking at the world. I think that's romantic hogwash.
is that not an argument against historical preservation at all? I mean, you can see a language just as a history in itself, or part of a history that's, you know, as valuable as anything kept in the Smithsonian in a museum.
Yeah, you can do, but unless you want to keep an individual or a group in a museum, in the Smithsonian.
Right.
You're going to have to accept that languages will change, will evolve, will die out, new ones will come into being. That's the nature of human progress, human life. That's the nature of being human.
Okay. So what are the forces for universalism? One of my favorite theorists is named Yifu Tuan, and he talks about going to a Christian school, he's Chinese, going to a Christian school when he was like 7 or something, and being completely bowled over by the idea of universalism, this Christian idea that that we're all equal or we all exist under God. What other forces in the culture push toward that?
Well, in a sense, the Christian notion of universalism universalism is a very important part of the Christian tradition, but it was also a constrained tradition because those who were not Christians were denied the benefits of Christian universality.
Yeah.
The real notions of universalism develops only in the 17th and 18th century through the Enlightenment, and particularly through the Radical Enlightenment. Jonathan Israel's wonderful series of books on the Radical Enlightenment shows, you know, that there's a distinction between the mainstream Enlightenment, which most people know and talk about, people such, you know, figures such as Kant and Locke and Hume, mm-hmm. and so on, and the Radical Enlightenment philosophers, people like Spinoza and Leibniz and Condorcet and so on. And it's out of the Radical Enlightenment that the modern notions of universality and equality arises. So I don't think, you know, universalism isn't embodied in particular historical cultures, but I think in particular political traditions. And the major traditions that draw on the Enlightenment, whether liberalism or Marxism, are both rooted in that universalist outlook, and anti-universalism is rooted in the counter-Enlightenment romantic tradition. Historically, though, a major shift has taken place over the past three or four, maybe decades, over the past half century. Historically, the left was universalist, the right was particularist. In recent years, however, this has reversed. The left has abandoned universalism for ethnic particularism and multiculturalism, and the right has embraced a kind of distorted notion of universalism and with its embrace of the free market. So there's a kind of shift that's taken place.
Is there? I wonder if there's a sense in which the nation state just in itself pushes against universalism. I mean, we tend to think of progress and history as moving towards cosmopolitanism, but the sort of World War One empires in Europe were polyglot, and after post-war you had sort of all these ethno-nationalist nation-state camps, and all of these different states have an interest in creating a separate history, sort of justifying their existence.
Well, I think there are positive and negative aspects of nation building and nationalism. I mean, on the one hand, nationalism is about overcoming the parochial aspect of any nation, so that the creation of the French nation, for instance, was about overcoming the parochial aspects of Bretons, right, and of Languedocs and so on, and creating a nation that overcame that. So there was a universalist impulse in that. But on the other side, as you suggest, nationalism is about imposing one's own particularism against other forms of particularism, other forms of nationality. So it's a double-edged sword.
Right.
And I think in recent years, it's the second aspect of nationalism that has predominated. And in that sense, it's become quite a reactionary way of thinking about oneself and one's identity.
Right. So once I hit the boundaries of my imagined community, which at this point in history is the nation state, I have an interest. I can assert an interest in cultural preservation, as we were talking about, and I can argue for closing the borders or some sort of neo policy to increase the birth rate or something of that along those lines.
We've got to remember that the nationalist movements, third world nationalist movements, when they began in the early 20th century, and when they gathered momentum in the post-Second World War, were quite progressive movements.
Mm-hmm.
Because their vision of themselves was not in that kind of narrow cultural sense, much broader, in a sense of wanting freedom for themselves and for their people in order to decide their futures. So we need to be a bit careful about the way we understand nationalism and nationalist movements. I do think there are two aspects of it. It's
sure.
just that in recent years, the political aspects of nationalism has reduced and become, as you said, much more cultural, historical, about preserving a kind of narrow parochial notion of what it is to be British or American or French or Irish or so on.
Sure, but anyway, as you say, in America, the very ability of a black man to say, I'm an American too, has been really important to equality. I mean, there is something to the expansion of the boundaries as far as they've gone.
Absolutely. And that's true not just of America. It means,
when I
was growing up, what was important for me was to be treated the same as everybody else.
Right.
And to be seen as British and to be accepted as British. Similarly in America, which is one of the reasons why Barack Obama's victory has meant so much, because it seems an expression of that feeling.
So where do you think this is going? I mean, do you feel like we're becoming even more obsessed with the idea of identity and biology as destiny, or are we moving toward a more cosmopolitan globalist worldview?
I think we're becoming far more obsessed with the question of identity, and we're having a much more parochial way of looking at the world. In a sense, if you look over the past 20 years, the politics of ideology has given way to the politics of identity. And that's been a big shift that's taken place. And so as that has happened, notions of social affiliations have changed. People no longer think of themselves and who they affiliate with in terms of politics, but much narrower terms of culture and history and heritage. So, you know, the questions people ask themselves isn't what kind of society do I want, and what kind of collective do I need to create in order to find the society, the kind of society we want, but rather who am I, what's my history, what's my heritage, and so identity has become much more about history and culture and heritage rather than about political affiliation.
Do you not sense some backlash against that worldview?
In what way?
There are always going to be pressures for assimilation.
The trouble with the assimilationist debate is I'm an assimilationist, but the way that the assimilationist debate takes place now is to say that, for example, in Britain, say this is British culture.
Yeah.
You come in and do as we do. Which is as reactionary as saying, this is Muslim culture or Islamic culture. We must do this. We must do things in this way.
Right. So the government of Quebec saying you cannot send your children to an English-speaking school is essentially their way of being assimilationist.
I think it's not a question of you can't send your children to an English-speaking school. It is more that there are certain things that are seen as assimilationism has become a means of pointing out the difference of other, who are seen as being unable to assimilate. They're not one of us. I mean, it comes out very, very well in France. France has got a very long Republican tradition, assimilationist tradition, and I'm very much a supporter of the French Republican tradition. Nevertheless, the assimilationist policies in France are about pointing up the difference of those who are deemed incapable of assimilating into French culture.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the same here, or this idea of orderly assimilation. We need to reduce immigration quotas because it's happening too fast for us to assimilate, and the question then becomes, what does that mean? I mean, and then you go back to all those questions about cultural preservation. What does it mean for your culture to be decaying if culture is something that's constantly fluid? Yeah.
Precisely. The immigrants somehow change the essence of what American culture is, or British culture is, or French culture is, rather than a culture always changes, and the changes that immigrants bring about is part of the change that culture always goes through.
Right. Well, will you tell us briefly before we go about your latest book and what inspired you to write it?
One that's coming out in the spring.
Yeah,
it's called From Fatwa to Jihad, and it's about the Rushdie affair and its legacy. It's the 20th anniversary. It's just the 20th anniversary of the publication of the Satanic Verse is just gone. The 20th anniversary of the Fatwa is next February. So I'm using that as a peg to look at the kinds of issues and themes that the Rushdie affair raised about radical Islam, the relationship between Islam and the West, questions of multiculturalism, and the questions of particular free speech and the limits of tolerance and so on. And to show how it's the myths about the Rushdie affair that have created the monsters that we all fear today. For instance, you take something like free speech and compare the response to the Satanic Verses to the response to The Jewel of Medina, Sherry Jones's book, which I don't know if people know much about. Sherry Jones is an American journalist who wrote a book called The Jewel of Medina about Aisha, the daughter of the wife of Muhammad, his youngest wife, who was a child bride. And it's a kind of breezy historical romance. Anyway, Random House had bought the book in America for $100,000 and were about to publish it. They sent it to a number of academics to try and get endorsements to use in the books. And one of the academics, Denise Feldberg, who's a professor of Islamic history, I think at the University of Texas. Anyway, she wrote back, outraged. This was an offensive book. Mm-hmm. It did not treat Muslims seriously. It did not treat Islamic history seriously. Random House dropped the book instantly. Right. No other major American publisher would touch it. Now, 20 years ago, a fatwa, a death sentence against Salman Rushdie, which forced him into hiding for 10 years, which meant that publishers, translators were assaulted, were killed, bookshops were firebombed, Penguin staff had to wear bombproof vests and so on. And yet Penguin continued to publish the book. These days, all it takes is an email from an outraged academic.
Is that a commentary on Penguin, or that's Penguin taking the temperature of the culture and seeing that they're going to have to pay in sales or whatever else if they do accept this book?
Random House, you mean? I think what's happened is that over the past 20 years, the fatwa has become internalized. Okay. That effectively, Western culture, Western societies have accepted that it is wrong to give offence, and that we do our best. Publishers, writers, editors do not want to give offence if at all possible. If you go back to the Danish cartoons, it was interesting, the response of Danish cartoons. Mm-hmm. People like Jack Straw, the British Home Foreign Secretary at that time, saying how wonderful it was that British newspapers and magazines did not republish the cartoons, and it was very disrespectful that those European ones who did. Bill Clinton saying how outrageous it was that the cartoons were published in the first place. There's a kind of general feeling that one must not give offence. And I think, in a sense, the critics of Rushdie, the campaigners against the Satanic Verses, lost the battle because the Satanic Verses continued to be published. But they won the war because the kind of world that they were looking for has come to be. And it's come to be because liberals have lost their bottle, have lost their spine.
Well, that sounds very provocative, and I hope you'll come back on so we can talk about that when in the spring.
Definitely, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so
much. Good to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.